This is Fernette Ide with the Dyslexic Advantage interview. Recently, I had the pleasure of talking to Doug Abrams, author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Book of Joy, Lasting Happiness in a Changing World. That book was co-authored with the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Doug is also founder of Idea Architects, a brain trust that helps visionaries create a wiser, healthier, and more just world. I opened my interview by asking Doug how it is that he came to work in the book publishing industry despite struggling mightily with reading and writing as a child because he's dyslexic.
Well, that's a great question, and I think it all goes back to Pepperidge Farm cookies because I was when I was a kid, I had a hard time reading and a hard time in school. And I was fortunate enough to grow up in New York City at the time, which actually, so I had access to some good reading therapy. And I remember going to this reading therapist's office, and they kind of had me strapped up to these machines that would have like move, kind of hide these pages, like they'd have these things that would push your eyes down the page and all sorts of things. But she had Pepperidge Farm cookies. I think they were Milano's. They might have been Brussels too. But I loved them. And so I was really motivated to do this reading therapy. And I was fortunate enough to have it. But I will say, you know, that kind of reading and literature and publishing in many ways was kind of the north face of Half Dome for me. It was kind of the steepest ascent. But I had a really, I kind of had a contrarian and somewhat rebellious personality. And, you know, one of the things that an English teacher said to me in junior high school was that I could never be a writer because I was dyslexic. And, you know, I mean, it sounds like from a Roald Dahl movie almost, you know, kind of sadistic teachers who tell you that you can't do what you most want to do. And I think coming from a publishing family, surrounded by books, you know, I kind of slept in a room. Actually, I slept in the dining room of our apartment in Manhattan, and there were books all around me, and they were kind of like screaming out, like, you can't read me. There was this kind of real kind of desire, but yet there's this a huge respect in my household because both of my parents were publishers for books and their wisdom, and I felt really motivated to participate in that world. And so I was hell-bent on proving that, you know, teacher wrong. You know, we can often be motivated by great mentors or by nemesis. And, you know, so I did, you know, I was fortunate enough to kind of, you were talking about narrative reasoning and that often dyslexic are good storytellers, and I actually had a knack for storytelling and won an award for one of my stories when I was younger, which was part of what gave me some of that fire in the belly and the feeling that I could do this. So it was like a combination between those things. And then that motivation to really, I mean, I think what I really love is ideas that change lives and change the world. And for me, you know, coming out of school, pre-internet era, that those ideas really lived in books, and I wanted to be a part of that and a part of sharing that. And it's true that even today when I walk into a bookstore, I kind of break out into a cold sweat, and now I, you know, am speaking and giving talks in bookstores, but I think in many ways, and one of the things that the Book of Joy reminds us, and that the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu remind us, is that in many ways, adversity is the way that we build our character. We think that our goal as parents is to save our children from suffering because we want to protect them. But in fact, it is actually that adversity and that challenge that we face that so often kind of molds our soul and our character.
I agree completely. Yeah, absolutely. Wow, that's wonderful. So just practical details. So I can see that you got the fire in the belly, that you had this desire. It probably broke through. There's a big gap, as you know, between reading and writing. Was Was there anything, and when did, was there some time where it seemed to click in? Was it a hobby? Was it something that once you got it, you were able to actually go with it? Tell me a little bit about your writing process, even when you're younger, well, and then older.
Sure. I mean, so I was, you know, kind of always telling stories, trying to write stories. I think, you know, once I did learn to read and write, you know, I am just a horribly slow reader still to this day. So it's, you know, I actually only read about half of the books that were assigned to me in school. So it's kind of funny sometimes when I've written two novels and people say, so what do you think about this work of great literature? I'm like, I didn't read it. Sorry. You know, this one, sorry, didn't write. So, but what I will say is I did have to, one of the things I had to do was I had to, because I couldn't often read the books or read them completely, is I had to come up with what they probably said. You know, I had to come up with what the story probably was, and because I definitely was fairly outspoken in class, and even if I hadn't read the material, I had to come up with a way of saying what it probably was. And so there was a combination, I think, of. And what that did was, I think that process of having to fill in the gaps was, I didn't have the experience of, like, my wife, who's an extraordinary reader and an amazing doctor, and, you know, she read all the works, and she knew everything, and she knew exactly the way it was supposed to be. And I didn't know how it was supposed to be, so it gave me a kind of blank canvas or some freedom to be able to make it up and invent it. And I think that even in that kind of absence was a freedom.
Wow. And so was college hard for you?
Well, I would say, you know, I wasn't pre-med like she was. It wasn't as hard as her. I mean, I think, you know, the reading and the books was always challenging. I loved the dialogue. I loved the conversation. And one of the things I would say is, you know, I think, you know, having worked with Richard Branson, for example, who's a fantastic a brilliant innovator and a dyslexic, you know, and many others, is that there's a way in which, you know, kind of our traditional culture is about monologue. It's about kind of dictating what students should know and what, you know, the way it should be. And I think dyslexics, because they have a hard time accessing that monologue, get very good at kind of talking back in some way and dialoguing and developing a kind of more dynamic understanding of a subject or a relationship. And so I would say the readings were hard, but the classroom and the relationships was fantastic. Mm. And I loved that. And I really was quite you know, adamant about this path. And I was able to be the editor of the newspaper in high school, for example. I was always a terrible speller and remain terrible, and homonyms are my downfall. I can't tell the difference between here, here, and here, or there, there, and there. But, you know, the wonderful thing is just being able to rely on others to support you. And I think one of the things that was so healing for, I mean, I think I grew up, like so many dyslexics, thinking my brain was broken in some way. And I think one of the things that when I was working with Desmond Tutu, or Arch, as he likes to be called, or Father, was he said, our vulnerabilities, our limitations, remind us of our need for one another. And it was such a healing reminder that the way my mind worked and my limitations was not simply just, you know, it was a reminder that my need for others to check my spelling or to, you know, be able to support what I was capable of doing wasn't a sign of my brain being broken. It was just the particular way that my mind worked that required the help and engagement of other intelligences. And I think that's such a powerful reminder of how we need each other and how we're so much smarter together.
Oh, that's beautifully put. Yeah, very beautifully put. Can I ask you how you started meeting some of these, you know, world famous people? I mean, what happened after college?
Sure. Well, so I read Richard Bull's What Color Is Your Parachute, which he became a client later in my career. But I read that book, and he encouraged people to do what were called informational interviews. And I went and did about 100 informational interviews and tried to find anything that I could do but book publishing, because that's what my parents did, and I was convinced that I needed to do something other than what my parents did, and strike out in a new direction. But ultimately, after doing all those interviews, I discovered that I really did love books and really did love words and really wanted to be in the book business. And so I had, I was following my wife around while she was getting her medical training, and she was in the Bay Area where there weren't many publishing houses, but I was able to get beat out 100 people through sheer perseverance, charm, and an obsession to get a job as an editorial assistant, which is kind of like a glorified secretary, and kind of you're sweeping the floors. And I worked there for many years, for almost a decade, and then was hired away to HarperCollins, where I became a book editor. And then, after working there for a number of years, decided that I was really, I was done making money for Rupert Murdoch, and I really wanted to work on the side of the angels, on the side of the authors, and really wanted to work, to bring the ideas that I felt were most important to the culture, that what we call, at my agency, books that create a wiser, healthier, more just world. And so made this list of about 25 people that I most wanted to work with in the world. Mm-hmm. And Desmond Tutu, the Dalai Lama, were both on that, as were with Nelson Mandela, who I've had the privilege of working with, and Richard Branson, and many scientists that I admired as well. And amazingly, I have had the incredible privilege of working with so many of them, pretty much all of them. I'm in the process of making a new list.
Wow. And you cold called them? I mean, is that what you did?
Well, you know, I say, you know, the way I would describe it is that I think there's something very powerful in knowing what you want, right? I think actually there's this strange kind of law of physics that we haven't yet identified, where when you really know what you want, I work with a world leading expert on the unconscious brain, and it's either we are priming our unconscious in some way, would be one kind of way of describing it in physical terms, or somehow we kind of bend the forces of the universe with our intention to support us. And so, for example, the story of how I started working with Archbishop Tutu was over a decade ago, when I made this list, I got a copy of his latest book at the time, which was called No Future Without Forgiveness, and I saw the name of his agent was a woman named Lynn Franklin. And a week later, I was at the Book Expo, and I was meeting with, which is the kind of national meeting of booksellers, mm-hmm. and I was meeting with a literary agent, and she said, "Oh, Doug Abrams, I'd like to introduce you to Lynn Franklin." And Lynn Franklin said, "Doug Abrams, I'm so delighted to finally get to meet you." And as it turns out, I inherited a book when I was at HarperCollins, which was, she was the literary agent for, and she had seen me in action in being the UN peacekeeping force between two feuding authors. But all I saw in the email thread was these initials, and I had never actually met her. So I said to her, "Well, I have a project that I want to talk with you about when you have a chance." And she said, "Great, give me a call." So I told her that, you know, Archbishop Tutu had given us his political message in a number of the books that he had written about South Africa, but he had never given us his spiritual message, his moral message. He had never told us really what were the values that allowed him to be the moral icon and the leader that he was, and the anti-apartheid struggle. And so we started talking, and we started talking with Archbishop Tutu, and I had the privilege of collaborating with him and helping to create that book, which was called God Has a Dream, A Vision of Hope for Our Time. And then now I've had the privilege of working with him, you know, in half a dozen books over the last 10 years, the latest being The Book of Joy.
Wow, that's incredible. You know, I noticed I was reading also about that novel that you've written, and it seemed to me that questions really drive maybe what you'll do next. And sometimes we've talked about this negative space thinking, and where people will say this, they will say this, but there's a real value for saying what people haven't said, but the undercurrent question. It seems like that has been a recurring theme in what you do. Is that right?
There are a lot of interesting things that are sparking as a result of what you're saying. I mean, I do think that a lot of my work is driven by questions. I mean, the first question that I was actually discussing with my daughter over breakfast this morning was trying to, you know, the question of what is the best use of me, you know, what gives me the greatest joy. And those are two things of kind of joy and contribution that I try to orient my life by. And the novels that I've had the privilege of writing have very much been driven by a question that I needed to answer. And often there are questions that are better in nonfiction, and there are questions that are answered often better by fiction. And the questions that are answered best by nonfiction are more intellectual questions, like the question we were trying to address in The Book of Joy, which is, how do you create more joy in your life? How do you live with joy in a world filled with suffering? How do you take joy, which is often a kind of fleeting mental state that comes and goes, and make it into an enduring character trait? So those were the kinds of questions that we were after in The Book of Joy. In the fictional realm, often what we're doing is educating our emotional life. In story, we are often kind of exploring the kind of nature of what it means to be human, because we are story dwellers, through our emotional life. And so those books were very much about kind of coming to terms with emotional questions that at the time had really challenged me.
Now, all this is fantastic. I really appreciate your just giving us the time to actually hear you, because so much of what you say, I'm sure will also affect a lot of people because of your insights. I do have to double back to one practical thing that is stuck in my brain that you mentioned at the start of this. It seems incredibly gutsy of you and anyone who's dyslexic and can't spell to hire yourself out as an editorial assistant. How did you do that? How did you possibly have the pluckiness to do that? Because was it just you so wanted to do it? I mean, how did that work? How come you weren't fired? I mean, it's incredible.
And this is before spell check, yeah. I should say. I learned in actually that editorial assistant job that if you are really good at what you want to do, even if you're not so good at what you're not don't want to do, you're good enough at what you want to do that you will be promoted to what you want to do and fired from what you're not good at doing. So I was pretty, you know, summarily fired from being an editorial assistant, but made an editor, because what I was actually loved doing was going and finding these amazing ideas and authors and books. And really what publishing house, they had people that could, you know, correct spelling and, you know, what are called copy editors, which is not what I wanted to do and not what I was good at doing. But what I was good at doing is what, or became good at doing, is what they call being an acquisitions editor. And And one of the things I tell young people when they're thinking about what work to do is I say, you know, be as close to the profit center of an organization as possible. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're doing the thing that generates the revenue for the company, which is what acquisitions editors do, they actually find the books that then generate the income for the publishing house, then they have both the most power in the organization and are the ones best compensated and least likely to be fired because they're central to the enterprise in a way that people who are often kind of more on the periphery, let's say like copy editors, are not. And so what's happened like in publishing is all copy editing is now out of house. It's freelance. And it's, you know, kind of, it's a necessary function. But I think this is coming back to our conversation about dyslexics is one of the real advantages that the kind of mind qualities that you were talking about that dyslexics have is they are often these kind of higher order reasoning skills and intuitive skills. What you were talking about, I think about intuitive reasoning, you know, one of my neuropsychiatrist authors, Dan Siegel, talks about as mindsight. And it's an incredibly important human quality. It's the intersection of empathy and insight. And it's a kind of, you were talking about kind of being able to understand things in ambiguous situations. And these are these incredibly important human capacities that more kind of linear thinkers, more kind of prosaic thinkers, if you will, no aspersions, but since we're using literary metaphors here, don't actually have in the same way or don't cultivate, or those aren't the strengths of their minds. But dyslexics often have these qualities, and it allows them to have a kind of another kind of superpower that even though it makes it hard in some of the more prosaic organizations like school and work to sometimes do those capacities and dispel those words like we were just talking about, it gives a kind of additional quality that if you can find that expression like I was able to as an acquisitions editor, it can be highly prized and rewarded.
Wow. Well, that's a huge insight and also pep talk, I think, for people who are trying to think about what can I do, you know, and I think there's, for the people, there are a lot of members of our community who their skill is like finding the new thing. It's something that's almost like a part of their personality. They've been doing it their whole life. The kernel of the thing where, you know, we've talked about among some of the people that we've interviewed, sometimes they talk about herd aversion, right? Where the herd is going this way and then they want to go the other way. And, you know, and after time, you know, you can find these great ideas that can be in people who are widely recognized, but you can also find the thing that nobody's recognized, but that you know is something that's really going to be a valuable thing to share with the world. So I think that's really neat that I've never heard about acquisitions editors from that perspective, but it makes complete sense. You know, it makes complete sense. Another funny thing is when we interview a lot of people in corporations, is we see a lot of people excel in the area of acquisitions and in business, that was a thing. And we interviewed a young person at Google and she said, my niche is I can bring these groups together that often, you know, they never work together or they may even hate each other, but I can see how to connect the dots between these people. And that is a gift. It's that, you know, filling in. I mean, I think the idea of you're also having Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama together, I think is really valuable too. You know, independent of people who are followers of each, you know, I think it actually gives even more the fact you have these two perspectives of these people. So, I mean, I think that was also a great idea of yours as well.
Speaks to the interconnected reasoning that you speak of, that ability to kind of draw, you know, connections. I mean, you know, I don't know what the brain structures are. I need to read your book to more fully to understand. But it seems to me like there's almost like dyslexic almost have a kind of alignment between the hemispheres of the brain or the different regions of the brain, and have a kind of integration that allows that interconnected reasoning to happen in a very powerful way.
You've been so nice by giving this great interview that I'm going to gift you with the audiobook.
I think the audiobook is definitely the gift. actually, the Book of Joy was audiobook was really fun because in the book there's, you know, the voice of the Dalai Lama and the voice of Desmond Tutu, and I was asked to be the kind of voice of the narrator and to bring in the science and to kind of narrate and weave their perspectives and their voices together. So we actually had three people doing the audiobook.
Wow.
And so it really kind of sounds like a radio play, and you get this experience of really being there in Dharamsala and hearing the dialogue and being on the journey, which is so fun.
Fantastic. Any wrap up? Do you have any advice to young people who are coming along?
Oh, I think just that, you know, if I had something to say to myself when I was younger, it would be that recognition that my brain wasn't broken, that it was a particular set of neural connections that were their own, had their own capacities and their own limitations, like everybody's brain. And just because often the structures of our society are not set up to encourage and support that way of thinking and that way of being, that it actually, if you can find, you know, if you can keep the faith and the hope and find a way to express your enormous talents and creativities, it's actually like having a superpower that allows you to do things that other people will marvel at and not understand, but you can wink to yourself and know that it was your adversity and your disadvantage that gave you that strength.
Hooray. Well, that's beautiful. Thank you so much.